This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanya.
And I'm Talia.
And we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Talia.
Hey, Tanya.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Like Tony the Tiger. I'm great.
Yeah, it did kind of sound like that, didn't it?
I'm doing just fine. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crimes and Consequences. I have a really disturbing's a good word, story for you today, and it's a bit gruesome. Actually, it's quite gruesome.
Wow.
I shouldn't say a bit. It's high on the gruesome scale.
Okay. You've been having a few of those lately.
Yeah.
You've taken a turn to the dark side.
I know. You see, your influence is wearing off
it.
On me.
Stop it.
Before I start, I just want to remind everyone to hit the subscribe or follow button on whatever app you're listening to. And I'd also like to give a shout out to Emily R. She is the one that suggested this story.
This gruesome story.
Yeah. Our Patreon, Emily R.
Well, thanks, Emily R.
Yeah, thanks, Emily.
I think.
Okay.
Let's get to it.
On March 13th, 1987, a woman named Terry Lemoine worked at a strip club called the Key Club in a sketchy area of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It was an area where you could find drugs and sex workers and where you better watch your back. Terry wasn't a dancer, but was there in case there was any trouble. Like, I don't know if she was like the den mom for the dancers or whatever.
All right.
Or if she bartended. I'm not sure exactly what she did. And on that night of March 13th, there was definitely trouble. A biker from the Sons of Silence.
The Sons of Silence?
Yeah. His name was Norbert David Dees. He went by Norby. He started an argument with one of the dancers. During their argument, Norby slapped the dancer across her face and Terry stepped in.
Oh, shit.
Terry ordered the girl to go to the dressing room before she turned and addressed Norby. She said, you know, does that make you feel like a big man, you know, slap a woman?
They didn't kick his ass out?
No. And she turned to walk away from Norby, like after she said this to him. But he wasn't ready for the situation to end because he grabbed a pool cue and he swung it at Terry, breaking it over her back.
What?
You know.
What a tough guy.
Right? Immediately after she was hit with the pool cue, Terry turned toward Norby and asked him, you know, have you lost your fucking mind?
I would have fucking said worse than that. Well, he needs to get the fuck out.
She was overcome with this blind rage. And she took one of the ends of the pool cue, one of the broken ends, and she started beating Norby with it. He tried to defend himself, but Terry was a woman of fury by then, and the jagged end of the cue just kept stabbing him. He fell to the floor, bleeding from his head and chest, but that didn't stop Terry.
Oh, fuck.
She kept at it, beating him until he rolled over on his stomach, hoping, you know, his back could protect him from the attack.
What's everybody else doing right now?
Standing around looking.
Okay.
Everybody's like, holy shit, right? The assault didn't end there.
Oh.
The dancer in which Norby had slapped came out of the dressing room, this time with a knife.
Oh.
And she started stabbing Norby in the back while Terry continued her assault with the broken pool cue, hitting him on the back and his head. The two women ended up beating Norby to death.
God damn!
I know. And the patrons at the Key Club didn't do much other than watch, like you mentioned. Although someone did end up calling the police. A hush fell over the room when everyone realized that Norby was dead, and Terry and the dancer backed away from his body. When the police arrived, they arrested Terry and the dancer, and both women were sent to the local jail. But not before the cops were like, hey, thanks for that one.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Like, I'm thinking Norby must have caused a lot of problems for the police.
Well, I mean,
I know.
I'm guessing.
After 3 days, the women were released, and Norby's death was deemed to be self-defense.
Wow, shit.
I know.
Well, right? I really did fucking hate him.
Mm-hmm. I know. Someone took a photo of Norby laying bleeding to death on the floor of the Key Club, and Terry keeps the photo in her wallet as a reminder to not let any man mistreat her. By the early 90s, Terry had moved on from the beating death of Norby and from working at seedy strip clubs, In 1994, she was working at a Circle K, and during one of her shifts there, her friend Sharon came into the store along with a man Terry had never met. Sharon introduced Terry to the man, and his name was Sean. She told Terry that she and Sean had a lot in common and that Sharon had been meaning to introduce them. Terry usually loved when her friends would drop by the Circle K because it was a nice distraction that helped break up the workday. But this visit by Sharon and Sean was not something that she was interested in. She told Sharon through clenched teeth to get Sean out of there. But Sharon refused. She was like, nope, you need to get to know him. I know you guys would make a great couple. And she left the store, leaving Sean there with Terry.
That's just all weird.
I know.
I thought Sean, I feel so uncomfortable.
I know, right? So they really had no choice but to get to know one another.
At the Circle K.
At the Circle K. Terry surveyed Sean with a critical eye and she thought, well, he is kind of good looking in a geeky sort of way with his brown wavy hair, glasses, and big bushy mustache. He had nice blue eyes, and although he wasn't very tall, he was about 5'7". She didn't mind. For the rest of the night, Terry worked that graveyard shift, so she's working an overnight. She and Sean got to know each other.
Was he just sticking around Circle K?
Yeah, he's just sticking around that Circle K, and in between customers, they would chit-chat.
It's a weird date.
I know. They discovered they really did have quite a bit in common. They liked the same food, TV shows, and movies, and they were both devoted Trekkies.
Oh, I personally am a huge Trekkie myself.
Awesome. They talked about everything that night, even religion in their past. By the end of her shift, Terry knew she wanted to see Sean again. And even though she didn't know it at the time, Sean felt the same. But she was hesitant. She was separated from her most recent husband, and the divorce was almost final. However, she really wasn't in a place where she wanted to start a new relationship with a man again. But Sean was so nice, and they had so much in common.
Mm-hmm.
So when he asked her out on a date, she accepted.
How did he get home from the Circle K? I'm just curious.
I'm wondering. I think Terry must have taken him home. My shift is done.
Our date is over.
Yeah. I know, right?
Okay.
I know. As they dated, Terry was still hesitant, like, to get close to Sean. She had been hurt so many times before in the past. She didn't know if she could fully trust Sean. I'm going to tell you, she had been in abusive relationships in the past. So one night during a small argument, she decided she was going to test him. While they were arguing, Terry smacked Sean in the face, wanting to see what would happen next.
What?
Would he smack her back? Was he going to hurt her? Sean didn't. He did the opposite of what she thought maybe he would do. And he got really upset with Terry, telling her, quote, girls don't hit boys and boys don't hit girls.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, that's a really weird test. I'm going to test my husband and slap him and just see
what's going to happen. And he was stomping his feet while he was doing this. Tears were forming in his eyes. Then he ran into another room. Terry realized Sean wasn't going to hit her or become violent, and she felt really terrible. But Sean had passed her test. She went to him and apologized and said, I'll never hit you again, and there's not going to be any physical violence in our relationship. After that, Terry realized that she could trust Sean, and she let her guard down fully. And the two fell deeply in love with one another. Sean gave Terry the affectionate moniker Honey Bunny, and Terry enjoyed the love and affection that Sean showed her. There were red flags, however.
Oh, I'm sure.
But Terry either didn't see them or she ignored them, instead choosing to eat up the kindness and love that Sean showered on her. Their sex life was a red flag. They didn't have one. They only had sex about 2 or 3 times during their decade-long relationship.
What?
Yeah, and this
really... That's a major red flag.
Thank you. And it really bothered Terry, initially.
Yeah.
Right? She confronted him about it once, and he told her he just wasn't interested in having sex.
Oh.
However, when she moved in with him in 1995, she realized he had a porn addiction. Again, this bothered her, but after a while... And after she questioned him about it, you know, was it something about me that you didn't want to have sex with me? You know, is it I've gained weight or what is it? He said, you know, there's nothing wrong with you. And he did assure her, I do like women, because she's like, do you even like women? And he said, yes. So she was just determined not to let it bother her.
Okay.
After being with men who abused her or mistreated her, Terry didn't mind that Sean's affection wasn't attached to a sexual relationship with her. Another red flag that Terry decided to ignore was that Sean would surf the web. I mean, he searched the deepest bowels of the internet.
I've done that before for some of our episodes.
I know. He found a site, though, once that had photos of dead women on it.
Oh, God.
And he showed the site to Terry.
What?
Hey, come here. Come check this out, is basically what he did.
Oh, look what you're looking at, honey. That's nice.
And when she saw it, she's basically like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, what are you looking at?
Fuck.
Yeah, and he just laughed at her reaction. And he continued to meticulously view the gruesome photos.
Oh, fuck.
So this is just a couple of the red flags.
Some major red flags, yeah. Dude.
I'm going to tell you now. I'm going to switch gears a little bit. The St. James Episcopal Church in Baton Rouge had been fundraising in the hopes of someday building a home for senior citizens, and their fundraising paid off. In 1983, a luxury home complex was built with the parishioners' funds, and people who lived there really loved it, especially Anne Bryan, who moved to the complex in 1990. Anne had recently fallen and broken her shoulder, which left her left hand and arm useless. Many people are able to overcome this disability. However, Anne had been born without a right hand. So now that she couldn't use her left one, she was really unable to care for herself after the fall. And she's about 78 at this time. This caused her to go into a deep depression. And Anne's children knew that since Anne couldn't play the piano, which she loved to do, or paint, or really do anything for herself, she would need around-the-clock care. Her children found St. James Place for her to live, so Anne sold her house and moved into an apartment there, determined to make the best of her situation. On the night of March 20th, 1994, Anne wasn't feeling well. A few days prior, she was driving with her daughter Rachel during an afternoon trip to the local mall. During the drive, Rachel had to slam on her brakes, and Anne, who was riding in the back seat, was thrown against the front seats violently, which caused her to break a couple ribs.
Oh, jeez.
Poor Anne. During that night of March 20th, Anne prepared for bed, and she left her apartment door unlocked, which she did most nights, thinking, you know, the night nurse was probably going to check in on her, considering she had these broken ribs, and the nurse would also bring her medication in the morning. And leaving the door unlocked was just easier for Anne because she wouldn't have to get up out of bed to answer the door when the nurse called. At around 3 a.m., Anne heard a noise and figured it was the nurse coming to check on her. However, she realized it wasn't the nurse when the figure of a man loomed over her bed. The man was Sean.
Of course it was.
Of course. He reached and touched Anne, and she screamed at his touch. She continued to scream when he climbed on top of her, clawing at her underwear. She screamed and screamed, but no one heard her, cries for help. Sean grew frustrated that Anne wouldn't stop screaming, so he took out the knife he had brought with him and began stabbing her over and over in an attempt to quiet her. She only stopped screaming when he viciously slit her throat.
Oh.
I know. So deep that she was almost decapitated. Anne quickly bled out, but Sean wasn't done with her.
Of course not.
Of course not, because this is a Crimes and Consequences episode.
Oh, God.
He continued to stab her dead body, enjoying the experience. He cut one of her breasts until it was only left attached to her body by a bit of skin. He stabbed at her face, her cheek, and chin, and her genitals, stabbing her vulva. He stabbed her stomach area so much that her intestines eventually protruded from her body. He nearly disemboweled her. Before he left, Sean had stabbed her 48 times. Anne's body was found in the morning by one of the employees at St. James Place who was coming to deliver her medication.
Oh, man, that employee.
Oh, fuck, right? Anne's body was found on the floor in her bedroom. Her body was facing her closet with her right leg and foot resting on her bed. Her killer had posed her body and removed her nightgown, exposing and humiliating Anne and her death. Much of the surfaces in Anne's bedroom were covered in blood splatter, her room confessing the viciousness of the attack that Anne had suffered. I should note that Sean killed Anne right around the time he met Terry.
Oh.
Yeah. It was the same month. So, just putting everything in perspective
here. Okay. So we're going back. Yeah. Switching gears.
Switching gears. A few years later, on January 4th, 1999, 30-year-old Catherine Hall was working the streets of North Baton Rouge. Catherine lived in a project housing nearby And she left home that night, like any other night, looking to make some money to feed her crack addiction. Catherine was a small African-American woman, petite, and she was familiar with most of the people who were on the streets of North Baton Rouge. However, when a white guy pulled up to the curb and offered her $20 for a blowjob, she looked him in the face and decided he looked like a nice enough guy.
Oh, God.
I know. Sean seemed harmless and smiling at her, so she got in the car with him. After she got in the car, he drove to a deserted area and parked. Catherine assumed that by parking, that was her cue to get down to business. But when they stopped, Sean had a different idea. As he leaned his seat back and unzipped his pants, Catherine bent over him. And as she was leaning over, Sean took out a plastic zip tie that he had brought with him. And before Catherine knew it, the zip tie was around her neck and Sean was tightening it. However, it wasn't tight enough, and Catherine fought back. As she was kicking and punching the air, she also felt for a door handle. She found the handle and freed herself from the car and took off running.
Fuck yeah!
While screaming for her life. Unfortunately, though, she didn't get very far before Sean caught up with her, and he knocked her to the ground. He had his knife ready in his hand, and once he got Catherine on the ground, he stabbed her 16 times. He stabbed her in her left eye.
Oh.
I know. He stabbed her breasts and stomach. And finally, one last slash across her neck, which caused her to bleed out. Once she was dead, though, again, like poor Anne, he wasn't finished with her. This is where the fun began for him. He took off Catherine's clothing, and the first thing he did was stab the knife through her arm, near her shoulder, and he pulled the knife downward. Cutting open her entire arm down to her hand. He cut around one of her breasts and cut open the other. He stabbed her stomach and vaginal area numerous times before cutting off one of her eyelids.
What?
I know, this is so fucked up. This wasn't the end of the mutilation, because he now turned her over on her stomach. His knife entered one of her buttocks and he cut down to her knee. Cutting her leg open.
So he's not doing anything sexual.
Not yet.
Oh, God. Okay.
He did the same to her calf, admiring the muscles in her body. And he stabbed and cut her 21 more times before he was finally done. After he was done carving her up, he picked up her body and put it in the passenger seat of his car.
Gross.
I know. He had to find a place to dispose of her. He took her clothing with him and left her jacket hanging on a fence nearby. Sean's next stop was at a car wash, where he removed Catherine's body and placed her on the cement while he cleaned the interior and exterior of his car. No one ever noticed.
What?
And he was able to thoroughly clean his car while her body, her mutilated body, mind you, laid next to his car.
But isn't he going to end up putting her back in it?
Yeah.
After he cleaned it?
Yeah. But, I don't know, do bodies bleed after
they die? Well, I mean, assuming, heart's not pumping anymore. It's still not be good.
I wondered this in this story, so I'm not sure.
Maybe he cleaned her, too.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
I'm
speculating.
Sorry. Her body was found the next day, January 5th, by a man who was out squirrel hunting on some land that was being developed for new homes. Sean had left her body near a dead end sign, which he thought was just hilarious.
Oh, yeah, that's so funny.
Yeah, it was fucking rich, right? Catherine's cause of death was determined to be bleeding out, because I can't say the other word, exsanguination?
Sounds good to me.
I don't know. And during her autopsy, a pubic hair from her killer was found in her mouth. A few months later, in May of 1999, there was this woman. She was 52-year-old Hardy Mosley Schmidt. Hardy was in great shape for being 52, and 52 is not old, so I'm not saying that.
No, absolutely not.
She was in awesome shape. She ran every morning, especially when she was training for a race, and she had actually ran in the Boston Marathon once, so she was a serious runner. She was training for an upcoming race on this day of May 30th, so she got up early to go running. Hardy enjoyed running in the early morning. She loved the quiet of the day, you know, before most people were awake. It gave her time to be alone with her thoughts, which she really enjoyed. She usually ran in her neighborhood, which was an upscale neighborhood in the suburbs of Baton Rouge, and she usually stayed in the street she knew for safety reasons. What she didn't know that morning as she started her run was that Sean had spotted her a few weeks before, and he became obsessed with her. He watched her run many times previously, and he coveted her, wanting her for his own. Unlike the sex workers he often watched, he knew if he tried to approach Hardy in his car, she probably wouldn't stop to talk to him.
Hell no.
So he was going to have to take another approach to stop her along her run.
He's going
to
hit her.
Yep. As she ran, he made the decision to step on the gas of the car he was driving, and he headed right for Hardy. She had no idea literally what hit her until the car plowed into her, driving her into a nearby ditch. Sean put his car into park and immediately ran out of the car toward Hardy with a zip tie in his hand. Hardy'd been knocked out by the blow, and therefore it was easy for him to strangle her to death with his zip tie. After he was satisfied she was dead, he picked up her body and put it in his car. He then looked around to see if anyone had noticed. No one had. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning. So he drove away, looking for an isolated spot where he could spend some time with his latest victim. He found a park after driving a few miles, and like I said, since it was 5 in the morning, it was deserted. He took Hardy from his car and laid her on the ground. He removed her clothing and admired her nude body, rubbing his penis along her body until he just couldn't stand it anymore. He raped her and ejaculated inside of her. Once he was done, he picked her up and put her body in the trunk of his car. Terry was getting off from work very soon, and he didn't have time to dispose of Hardy's body before he picked Terry up.
Oh, that's right. He's living with Terry.
Yes. Therefore, he went and picked Terry up from the Circle K while Hardy's body was in the trunk. He left her body in the trunk for a couple days.
Oh.
Before he finally dumped her near a bayou in St. James Parish along a highway. She was found the day she was dumped. Her husband, Bob, who was an attorney in Baton Rouge, was a suspect in her murder 4 years.
Oh.
Before Sean's arrest. A few months after that, on November 12th, 1999, Sean had the urge that could only be satisfied by finding another victim.
How have I never heard of this asshole?
I know, right? Seriously.
What?
Because I think at the time in Baton Rouge, when all this was going on, I think there were probably 5 serial killers.
Yeah, you're right.
And I did a story about one of them. Derek Todd Lee.
Yeah.
And I have another one that I'm going to be doing as Patreon coming up. I didn't realize when I read the books that they were both Baton Rouge at the same time, but I think there was just so much shit going on that I think the police were overwhelmed, and I don't know. I know, I've never heard of this guy. I'm sure some of our listeners have. Anyway, so on November 12th, 1999, Sean dropped Terry off to work, and he began driving around looking for his latest target. As he drove along the highway, he noticed a black woman who had beautiful legs walking along the road wearing a flowing garment. He described it was similar to a nightgown.
She's walking along the road?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
He drove by her at first and then turned around and drove by her again. The second time he drove by, he stopped and rolled down his window. 36-year-old Joyce Williams came up to the window. Sean asked her, where are you headed? And she said she was headed to a girlfriend's home to score some weed.
Why is she coming up to the window?
Hey, girl. I know.
I'm not blaming her.
I know. Sean said, well, get in. I'll take you to your friend's house. And also, how about I give you $10 if you give me a blowjob? She's like, sure.
Okay.
$10.
That's, yeah. Tanya's prices are much higher. Sorry.
It's okay. So she gets in. She's like, yeah, sure. Why not? Sean took her to her friend's house and she made her sale and came back to Sean's car, handing him a beer that she got inside. They chatted, and Joyce sang along to the radio as they drove. She became concerned, though, when they drove over the Mississippi River Bridge because she was out of the parish where she lived, and she's like, wait a minute, this isn't my usual stomping grounds. She said, you know, though, I'd be worried if you weren't such a nice guy. So, you know, basically, though, she did say, like, what's up? Sean found a spot in a sugarcane field nearby, and he parked the car. Joyce said she had to pee and got out of the car. Sean followed her and decided this is a perfect opportunity to put my plan into action. He came up behind Joyce with his zip tie and he strangled her to death. After she was dead, Sean put her body back into the car and secured her with the seatbelt. He was going to take Joyce back to his house because it would be hours before Terry was due to be picked up, and he really wanted to take his time with Joyce. As he drove her home, her head slumped into his lap, where he was like, oh yeah, baby.
No, stop it. I know,
it's fucking gross. Sean brought Joyce into the kitchen of the home, and let me tell you how he described what happened next. Sean said, quote, I laid her down in the kitchen by the bar and sink and stroked her body. The usual sick playing with her. She had beautiful legs. I wanted to keep those legs. I used a sharp knife to cut through the muscle of her leg, but it took a while to get through it. I cut too low. I finally got it off with a hacksaw and went for the next leg. The blade snapped on me when I was about halfway through the femur. I remember trying to get her arm off next. There was a lot of blood. I sopped it up with paper towels, packing paper, which is very absorbent, 409, and water. I used one of Terry's knives, a fillet knife that was razor sharp. You gotta be careful handling it. I tried to get the arm at the elbow, then the wrist. Things were popping out of joint, but I couldn't get it off, even though I twisted it real good.
Oh, gosh. No.
At that point, I pretty much went for the head. The knife went through just like that. It was like cutting butter.
What?
With Ms. Bryan, and that was Anne, if you remember, I couldn't get through. When they are alive, the muscles in the neck make it harder. There was a lot of blood, so I washed her head in the sink. I inserted my penis into her head.
Stop. Stop it.
In her throat. Her spinal cord or something.
Oh, no.
Pricked my scrotum.
Stop it. Okay. Just stop. Okay.
Okay. It was very uncomfortable.
Oh, I bet.
I guess I got what I deserved.
Oh, my goodness.
It wasn't a sex thing. It was a mind thing.
Okay.
It was more just to see what it was like. I didn't, you know, get off.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that makes it better.
Then I put my penis in her mouth.
Oh.
After that, I picked up her leg, holding it with the foot close to my face.
Her leg?
Mm-hmm. The one he cut off. He cut both of them off, actually. No, he cut one off. Severed and down. She had lovely legs, like Terry.
I'm going to vomit.
End quote.
Like Terry?
Like Terry.
Well, now we know why he wasn't banging Terry.
Right? He wasn't quite done.
What?
As I've told you before, he's never quite done until it's just 10 times grosser than you thought.
It can't get 10 times grosser than I thought, well, Tanya.
It does. Because
impossible.
He had to kick his perversion up a notch. Okay, are you ready?
Oh, I don't know.
This is fucking disgusting.
Because you just told me some really horribly.
Yeah, it gets worse.
Oh, Lord. Oh.
He cut off both of Joyce's nipples, and he held them in his hand. He rolled them between his fingers before making the decision to put them in his mouth and eat them.
Oh.
Now it was getting close to the time where he'd have to leave to pick Terry up, so he folded Joyce's remaining leg over her torso and crossed her arms in front of her before putting her body in a black garbage bag. He put her severed leg in another bag and her head in a third. He put the bags in a box and loaded them into his car. He then scrubbed his kitchen floor and cleaned up any evidence that could be seen by the naked eye. He drove to pick up Terry with Joyce's dismembered body, which he thoroughly enjoyed.
Oh, my goodness. I know.
He said he felt so powerful with Terry in the same car. I know.
Oh, Lord.
Tell me about it. Poor Terry. He felt powerful, I said, with Terry in the same car as Joyce's body. So there wasn't any nervousness or awkwardness when he picked her up. He greeted her with, hi, honey bunny. And Terry smiled because he was just always so sweet to her. He dropped her off at home, and while she drifted off to sleep, Sean looked for a place to dump Joyce's body. He found a levee to dump her. He said, quote, I got the box out of the trunk and slung her leg down first. Then I slung her head. It went bloop, bloop, bloop all the way down.
God, he's a sick bastard.
I know. The torso was last because that was harder. Joyce wouldn't be found until January 22nd, 2000, which was 2 months later, when her leg bone was found by two men who were walking behind the levee birdwatching, and they stumbled upon the bones. The rest of her body was found 4 days later, on January 26th, and she was eventually identified 2 weeks later through dental records.
Poor Joyce.
I know. When she was identified, the police made flyers to help. They were looking for the killer. And Sean came across one of these flyers while he was servicing a broken copier at the Louisiana State Attorney General's office. He was working for an office supply company at the time, and he came across the flyer on accident. However, after he found it, he made 200 copies of the flyer, lovingly caressing Joyce's face after each copy came out of the machine.
So weird.
I know. Her death and dismemberment became a favorite memory that Sean used to bring up in his mind over and over, and it made him desperate to kill again, to relive the experience. 52-year-old Lillian Robinson had once led a good life. She had family who loved her, children and grandchildren, but at some point, she turned to alcohol to help her through life's difficulties. A little drink here and there eventually turned into full-blown alcoholism, and then it went downhill after she tried crack for the first time.
Crack is smack.
I know. Lillian became addicted to crack, and her life just went to shit. Sean found her in January 2000 in North Baton Rouge and offered her money for oral sex. Lillian got into his car, and he drove to a secluded place and strangled her to death with a zip tie. He drove her to his house, just as he had done with Joyce, but he realized he wasn't going to have enough time to dismember her and enjoy her like he had done with Joyce. He did take her into the house and undress her and played with her dead body for a while, touching her breasts and vagina and putting his penis in her mouth. He took her body to his car after he was done, and he would eventually dump her.
He didn't mutilate her?
No. He dumped her in the Atchafalaya Basin.
Oh, I'm sure that's wrong.
I'm sure it's wrong. Somebody's going to correct me. I know it. Where he put her body in the swamp. He figured she's never going to be found, that the gators would get her before anyone found her, but he was wrong. Her body was found floating in the water by some fishermen in March 2000, miles from where Sean had originally discarded her. Before I tell you more, we're going to take a break. In October 2000, which is about 9 months after he killed Lillian, Sean was on a trip to Lafayette, Louisiana, to visit his goddaughter, Christine.
Oh, he's got a goddaughter?
Mm-hmm. When he decided he needed to go hunting for a new victim. He wasn't planning on picking anyone up during this trip, but he gave in to his urges when he saw 38-year-old Marilyn Nevels walking along a busy road, and he smiled at her. He offered her a ride, and when she got in the car, he asked her, "How much is it for a blowjob?" She told him $10, and he agreed. He drove them to a deserted spot, and he paid Marilyn before she gave him oral sex. When she finished, Sean grabbed his handy-dandy zip tie and got it around Marilyn's neck. She was able to fight back, enough where she was able to get out of the car, and she started to run, but like Catherine Hall, it didn't take Sean long to catch up to where she was. Before he caught up with her, though, he found a piece of rebar and grabbed it, and he hit Marilyn over the head with it when he caught up with her. He hit her over the head hard, several times, eventually killing her. Marilyn still had the zip tie around her neck, so just to make sure she was dead, he tightened it, and once he was sure, he dragged her body back to the car. He put her on the floor in the passenger side, and he took the $10 he had paid Marilyn for the blowjob, and he put it in his pocket. He chuckled to himself as he did this, thinking, you know, it wasn't a bad blowjob. Ha ha ha.
What is this shit?
I know. He got into the car and he drove to another car wash, laying Marilyn on the
floor.
Yes, like he had done with Catherine.
Anytime I've ever been to a car wash, there are other people there.
I know. And I'm thinking, is this the middle of the night? It might be the middle of the night. I think he did a lot of this, like, in the late night hours. But seriously, no one fucking sees it. These are big cities. Baton Rouge,
Lafayette. Car washes aren't usually out in the middle of nowhere.
No. Exactly. I've got one by me, like, that you spray yourself and whatever. It's along a busy fucking road. I don't know. He cleaned the blood from the floor of the passenger side. After he was done cleaning out the blood, he put Marilyn's body in his trunk, but wrapped her head in some sort of towels that he had to prevent more blood from getting on the carpet in the trunk. I guess he didn't want to spray out the trunk. He stopped to get gas next. And when the gas station attendant remarked about the blood that was all over Sean's shirt, like, oh, he said, oh, you should see the other guy.
Oh.
And he paid for his gas. Sean was planning on taking Marilyn back to his house because he had several hours before Terry was due to get off from work. But he had to stop at a rest area because he was anxious to see Marilyn naked.
He just couldn't wait.
He couldn't wait. When he stopped, he opened the trunk and looked at her.
Again, this is a public place.
I know. Come on, right? the anticipation of getting her home building inside of him. He hurriedly got back into the car and drove home. Once he got home, he brought Marilyn into the house and propped her up on the kitchen floor, her back against the kitchen cabinets. He started to undress her and she urinated, and when he touched the puddle, it felt warm to the touch. Sean thought, well, that's weird that the liquid is still warm, and it repulsed him. So he took Marilyn's body to a shower, and he placed her naked body in the shower before turning on the water. He got undressed and joined Marilyn in the bath, and he had trouble keeping her sitting up. She kept slumping over. He tried to put his penis in her mouth, but her jaw had locked up, so he was unable to open it wide enough.
This is so
fucking weird.
Oh, Lord.
He held her in the shower for several minutes and wanted to mutilate her, but he realized he wasn't going to have enough time. He got out of the shower and wrapped Marilyn's body in Xerox wrapping paper and put her in his car.
Xerox?
Yeah. I guess they had wrapping paper. It's not, I don't think it's wrapping paper like present wrapping paper. But apparently it's very absorbent. I don't know.
Okay.
He wanted to dump her body in the Mississippi River, but he couldn't. Instead, he left her nude body on the top of a levee, where she laid for 11 days.
11 days?
I know, before her remains were discovered. She was found by a man walking his dog on Halloween. No one ever reported her missing.
Aww.
I know, that made me really sad. Sean didn't kill again for 3 years. He didn't go away to prison or anything like that. He just lived his life with Terry during those 3 years.
How did he resist those urges?
I know, that's what I wonder. I'm not sure. Because these were like within months.
Yeah, and he couldn't resist having to pull over.
Right.
Just to see her naked body.
I don't know. This was also the time where Derek Todd Lee was active, and he was fascinated by the news reports, like when he got arrested and stuff. So I don't know. So 3 years after he murdered Marilyn, 45-year-old Johnny Mae Williams was a woman who was loved very much by her family.
Her name is Johnny?
Johnny Mae.
Johnny Mae.
After a divorce, Johnny Mae moved to Baton Rouge with her boyfriend. For a while, he was good to Johnny Mae. They had a beautiful house, cars, a swimming pool, and expensive vacations. Her children loved living with them. But soon there were rumors that he was cheating on Johnny Mae, and she turned to drugs to dull the pain she felt. She soon became addicted to crack, but she would often try to get clean. Her children lived with their father while she was going through these drug binges, and she visited them when she was sober. But the addiction proved stronger than she was, and she would eventually go back to using, like, every time. Johnny Mae was different from Sean's other victims in that she knew him personally, and they were kind of friends. He worked for a time at the same Circle K that Terry worked. He worked the opposite shift. And he was introduced to Johnny Mae by a friend of hers who knew Sean was looking for someone to clean his home here and there, like occasionally.
Oh, man, I don't know about cleaning Sean's home.
I know. During one sober Thanksgiving, Johnny Mae even invited Sean over for a turkey dinner with her family, and he went. Their friendship drifted apart over the years, but they still saw one another every so often, and sometimes they'd smoke weed together. On October 9th, 2003, Sean went looking for her when he wanted some weed. He drove to North Baton Rouge and he found her. He offered her a ride and she accepted. He noticed that she was obviously strung out on crack, and she was just all skin and bones at this point in her appearance. As they drove, Johnny Mae put her seat back and closed her eyes. As Sean glanced at her, he thought, she looks dead. And then he thought, she was in such bad shape that she needed to be dead.
Oh, like he's doing her a favor.
Yeah, I know. He pulled his car over in a secluded spot and parked the car. When he parked, he got out of the car and went over to Johnny Mae's side and pulled her out. He ended up beating her to death with his fists. I don't know how, but okay. And she didn't put up a fight due to her being so strung out. When he was sure she was dead, he removed all of her clothing. He got his knife from his car and went back to Johnny Mae's body. He turned her over on her stomach and first plunged the knife into the back of her leg, which he sliced open.
Oh.
He then punched her buttocks and took the knife and cut into those after punching it. He cut into her lower back and cut until he reached her buttocks. He cut and stabbed Johnny Mae all over, cutting her legs open and marveling at the muscles and veins that he saw. He turned her over And when he did, he ended up cutting off both of her hands. He took those with him in a Ziploc bag. I don't know what he did with them. After he was done carving up Johnny May, he picked up her body and put it in his car. He dumped her along an embankment in a wooded area. He posed her body on her stomach with her arms tucked under her and her butt in the air. He had a camera with him and took pictures of Johnny May and Death, which he would revisit over and over in the coming future.
Such a bastard.
I know. Her body was found by a young boy who was out with his dog when he smelled the scent of something rotting. Thinking it was an animal, he investigated further and found Johnny May. A few months later, on February 27, 2004, 20-year-old James and his girlfriend Laura were driving around Baton Rouge, looking for their dog who had run off earlier that morning. As they drove over a bridge for a small canal, they saw something that just didn't fit in with the landscape of the area. It appeared to be a woman's body, so the pair parked their car to get a better look on foot. As they got closer to her, within about 10 feet, they realized it most definitely was a body that they were looking at, and she definitely was dead. James immediately called 911 from his cell phone to report what they found. The woman's body was nude and had been posed by her killer on her stomach with her butt raised in the air slightly. There was a jacket that covered her face and her right arm. Her back had abrasions on it, and she had most likely suffered those abrasions when her killer dragged her body down the embankment from which she now lay. She was missing her left arm. It had been severed at the elbow. And her arm wasn't with her body. She also had a large piece of her left upper thigh missing that police would eventually realize was a tattoo that the woman had. And it had been removed, like her arm, by her killer.
What is he doing with these pieces of body? Like the hands in the Ziploc bag?
I don't know what he did with Johnny May's hands. But I know with this victim, he just dumped them after he dumped the body. There was dried blood around her anus and vagina, evidence of a likely sexual assault. As the police investigated the area surrounding where the woman was found, they saw tire tracks, and they took a mold of that. They also found a piece of flesh where the tire tracks ended, and it was described as being maybe a piece of cartilage. When police got to the woman's body and they rolled her over, they noticed she had ligature marks across her neck and a very large slash. On her left arm, above her elbow, there were several deep knife wounds. Her breasts had been mutilated as well. Her killer had cut both nipples and areolas from her body. They, along with the arm and the tattoo, were missing from the scene. Obviously, I'm telling you this because Sean murdered this woman, who was identified as 43-year-old Donna Bennett Johnston. He had picked her up around 3 a.m., and she was shit-faced, making it very easy to kill her. He strangled her to death with his favorite murder weapon, the zip ties, and when she was dead, he placed her body in the trunk of his car until he could find a secluded spot. When he got to a place where he felt safe, he opened the trunk and took pictures of Donna's body before he removed her from the car. When he got her on the ground, he took off her clothes and then mutilated her, removing her arm, her tattoo, the areola and nipples, which he ate.
Oh, I had a feeling. Yes.
Oh. He said he didn't like the taste particularly, but he enjoyed the experience of keeping a part of Donna within his body. It kind of reminded me of Jeffrey Dahmer when he would say he would do that. Like, that's why he cannibalized some of his victims. I know, this dude is fucking gross. He moved Donna's body from where he mutilated her, wrapping her arm in a dishcloth he had in the car and her tattoo in some paper towel. He took more pictures of Donna's mutilated body once it was back in his trunk. And he took pictures of him fondling her vagina and breasts. He took 45 pictures in total.
Where's he keeping these pictures?
They're on like a file in his computer.
Oh.
And I have to tell you, when he was prosecuted, the prosecutor's like, he took these pictures and his license plate is in the photo. Like, he just didn't think. He dumped Donna's body. And it would be her murder, which would end up being his undoing. The tire tracks he left when he dumped her body were from a rare tire that only less than 200 people had in the Baton Rouge area. When police confronted him with it, he initially denied being involved in Donna's murder, but they were able to collect a DNA sample from him, and that tied him to other murders. His dumbass, they were like, we're going to take a swab, and he's like, okay.
Sure, no problem.
Sure, no problem.
I've got nothing to hide.
I know, like, dude. He was arrested after police busted into his house that he shared with Terry. And she was terrified at the abrupt intrusion. She was like, what the fuck? The police found them in bed together, and while they were arresting him, Terry was dumbfounded. She asked officers, like, what's going on?
He's a nice guy.
Yeah, like, what the hell? What is this? And the officer said to her something like, don't you know you've been living with a serial killer?
Oh, fuck.
I know. And then she turned to Sean, and she's like, what the hell? And he's like, I'm sorry, honey bunny.
Oh.
I mean, what a fucking shock, right?
That's what she needed to get to the pool cue and just stab him.
Right? I can't even imagine what this poor woman went through. Oh,
man.
After his arrest, Sean gave a full confession. And they described his confession as him boasting about the killings and being really proud of what he did.
Yeah, after that quote you read from him.
Yeah, I'm sure that was from his confession.
Yeah, he doesn't seem like he even cares.
No, he never showed any remorse, and he was almost excited to tell them about everything he did. Sean was sentenced to life in prison without parole, and he escaped the death penalty by only 2 votes. Terry remained in the house.
No.
And she remarried.
No.
And as far as I can tell, she still lives there.
Oh, man.
I know.
No, thank you.
Isn't that crazy?
Well, it probably isn't worth much if you try to sell it.
I know. I'm pretty sure she remodeled a lot, too. Because I think the police came and obviously ripped up the kitchen floor and got, you know, blood evidence and everything. And I'm sure she remodeled, but I didn't really talk about Sean's childhood because
because who gives a fuck about him?
I didn't. There was a book that I read for this story. It was called Dismembered.
Of course it was.
And it's by Susan D. Mustafa and Sue Israel. I know I've read books by Susan Mustafa before, but it was a good book if you're interested. It does go into Sean's background and all kinds of other shit. Before we go, we have some shout outs.
Oh yeah, we haven't done shout outs
in a long time. So
I will give you the pleasure.
All right. We would like to thank Taylor D., Samantha D., Christina H., Laura W., Paula K., Chastity P., Anita D., Laura L., Melanie B., Crystal P., Christy F., Jenny E., Shiloh H., Margaret H., Mark Bush 5326, Amanda M., Barco V., Sarah J., Jacqueline N., Karen B., Kayla G., Tracy O., Emily T., Victor F., Sasha H., Ryan M., Sonia T., Christy B.
Wow.
Jarius. I'm sorry if I mispronounced it. I'm sure he did. Sorry. Bradley L., Sadie M., Susan M., Lynn L., Denise C., Eric H., Liz C., Terrence, and then Ashlyn S. And I also told her I'd wish her a happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
I might be late. I might be early. Tara K., Emily C., Kelly H. We also got a very lovely card from Terry and her dog, Seven.
Oh, yeah, that was sweet.
It was very sweet. Thank you, Terry. We really, really appreciated the card. It was so nice of you. And last but not least, we need to give a shout out to Nina R.
Nina R.
Who works with Shayna.
Hi, Nina R. Thank you for your support.
Yes, thank you, Nina.
Woo!
Woo, woo, woo.
Oh, thank everybody.
Yes, and in case you're wondering why we're giving shout outs to people.
It's because they're cool.
For one. They're also members of our Patreon group and our Apple subscribers. And you can learn more about it by going to our website, crimesandconsequences.com. They are subscribers who receive additional episodes that are not released to the public.
And they get early releases without ads.
Exactly.
We get a lot of fun things. We're going to go live soon.
Soon.
We haven't been able to do it in a while.
Yeah. Shit happens.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
You can also find us on social media, on Facebook and Instagram, at Hardcore True Crime.
Once again, our website, crimesandconsequences.com.
So check us out.
Anything else? We got merch there.
Got merch there. So if you love us, check us out.
We love you. We thank you all so much for listening to us. It means the world to us.
Absolutely. We wouldn't do this without the support of you guys.
Until next time, Tanya, what should they not do?
Don't kill each other. I did your line.
Yeah.
Bye.